Good evening, it's 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Juliana Gonsalves. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie. Let's start off with your local news headlines. A group of medical students at Queen's University are organizing action aimed at addressing housing and homelessness in Kingston. While it's called the Queen's Medicine Municipal Day of Action, the work has been underway for weeks. Students have been meeting with local service providers, community organizations, and experts, and are now bringing their findings directly to city councillors. The last time the event was held was in 2021, also focusing on housing and homelessness. This year marks a five-year follow-up, as homelessness in Kingston has risen by 133% over that period. First-year medical student Zara Rahman and second-year student Tim Song spoke with CFRC about how the initiative came together.
So this initiative is called the Medical Day of Action, or the Municipal Medical Day of Action, and it is run by a team of medical students right here at Queen's. There are a lot of similar initiatives that happen all across Canada, whether it's through province, whether it's through the entire nation, where we meet up in Ottawa. And we wanted to do something more local here in Kingston as a group of medical students. So the Medical Students Society, also called the Aesculapian Society, has a group of medical students who are specifically working towards equity and advocacy as a committee. And these medical students work independently to do different things around Kingston and around Queens to try to make a difference. For example, we host fundraisers. For example, we host different awareness events. And this year, we wanted to bring back an event that's happened previously at Queen's, the School of Medicine, called the Day of Action. So that's kind of how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is the first time this has come back since 2021. I was wondering if you could speak to why you decided to bring it back now and why revisit this topic.
Yes, for sure. So this initiative used to be a lot bigger pre-COVID, where people were able to meet in person. Basically, as a quick overview of what a day of action is it basically is a bunch of medical students or health professionals looking through the community, whether it's municipal, provincial, or national, like I stated before, to see if there's any issues that as medical students or health professionals we could address. So this was a lot easier to do, as you can imagine, to try to talk to city councilors or talk to municipal government in person. So over COVID, it kind of died down. But just as an example of a few different things that the Kingston team used to work on includes water fluoridation, very important. We don't have that here in Kingston, as well as homelessness relief or housing for the precariously housed, which is, again, a very pertinent issue here in the Kingston community. So as things got back to coming in person and we started having more lively discussions about how we can make a change here at Queen's, the first thing we kind of stumbled upon was this program called the, or this initiative called the Municipal Day of Action. And as we were looking back at past references, talking to past organizers to see what would be a good fit for us moving forward, we found that the topic that they addressed in 2021, housing and homelessness, would be a perfect fit based on all of the pertinent issues that are happening here in Kingston today.
And to add on, we felt like it was very important in the times that we're in right now. So since 2021, homelessness in Kingston has risen, and we've also seen that there are a lot of different barriers. And I think even looking at this politically on how much of this becomes a pertinent topic, this is something that is continuously discussed. And we felt that it may be best for us as medical students to advocate for our future patients, especially considering all the different barriers and how health, there's so much more research coming out now, especially since COVID, on how the social determinants of health. So for those who don't know, those are kind of just factors in your life like income or housing and how much that can actually impact your health. It's not usually just, you know, exercise or diet. It can also be where you live, how much money you have, what access to resources you have. And we found, at least through our research, that with homelessness rising in Kingston, there's also a reduction in those health outcomes as well. And then that could also tie into other issues like wait times in hospitals, for example, in emergency wait times, for example. So we kind of looked at this more holistically as we went throughout our research.
From their consultations, the group developed two key asks for council, focused on improving housing services and health outcomes for unhoused residents. The first calls for better data collection and coordination across services.
We kind of did a more of a deep dive into the research. We looked into health outcomes. We looked into how different municipalities approach this. And one thing we found, as Tim mentioned, was data and the importance of it. So when we did the deep dive, we looked into, so United Way, for example, in Kingston does a lot of data checks. So there's something called the by name list. So not going into the specifics because it is quite complex, but basically the by name list identifies the individuals who are unhoused in Kingston. And these are individuals that are comfortable being recognized and has all of their data, and it allows us to keep track on them and make sure that they're okay. And the way that the city of Kingston does it right now is that they just list how many people are unhoused. So for example, I believe currently it's over 500 in 2025. But as we've mentioned before, there are a lot of barriers to that data, and it may not give the full holistic idea of what's going on, and that can impact what policies we're able to provide in Kingston. So the ask that we have right now is to make sure that that data, so the by name list, or there's something called the Homeless Individuals and Families Information System, has a good idea of who is being unhoused and then who is being housed, so inflow and outflow. And this is important to have, you know, for example, either on housing for homelessness, like as an annual report, just to make sure we have an idea as the city to know where people are at, where folks are at, and to see what different barriers they're experiencing. And then also having a good monthly report card. So I believe it was either United Way or one of the community organizations that did an evaluation on the data and the situation of homelessness in Kingston. And they found that, unfortunately, the data is just not as well upkept in Kingston. So there is that gap. They reported this as being a huge barrier. I believe it's only updated monthly. And sometimes there can be difficulties in recognizing who's being housed and who's not being unhoused. Because when you're living, for example, on the street, and then you were housed and then now you're not housed, that's a day by day. You're surviving day by day, not month by month. So we also looked into other jurisdictions. One, for example, is in Hamilton and the Durham District as well. So in Hamilton, what they do is that they have a lot of comprehensive data. So they not only provide like how many people are unhoused in Kingston, but how many people were housed, how many people are, for example, of different marginalized communities, how many of them are women, how many of them are Indigenous, and then how many of those have been approached, for example, by someone to get housed. So I think that provides more of a realistic idea of what's going on the ground versus just these are how many people are unhoused. And I think that can really benefit, one, the government, the municipal government, especially just to figure out when you are coming up with policies, what support you can give. But also I think for the people of Kingston, I think that this would allow for a lot more grace and I think a lot more empathy if you just have an idea of what someone is experiencing and the different layers of it versus just seeing a number, because we as individuals are not just numbers. We all have different stories. And I think having that data would be able to have that better picture of what's going on.
Their second ask emphasizes incorporating Indigenous housing models into local approaches.
So as medical students, we often see, or we often try to look at which populations are more vulnerable or more susceptible to for different health issues. It's the social determinants of health that Zara talked about earlier. And the thing that we, I guess, focused on this year was the sheer number or sheer disproportionate number of Indigenous individuals mm-hmm. who are experiencing homelessness, not just in Kingston, but globally. We talked to a lot of different community groups here in Kingston itself. We had a conversation with the Language Nest. We talked to 4D. We talked to the Ikanu Patient Services, which is a group that works up with the James Bay Indigenous folk and bringing them back and forth with KGH. And basically, we've decided that we want to ask for more Indigenous-led housing, culturally grounded prevention services, wraparound supports, and basically just strengthening the city of Kingston's truth and reconciliation commitments. So All this to say, for both Ask One and Ask Two, the city has been doing amazing work. Mm-hmm. When we talk to some of the different organizations like the Canadian Association for Ending Homelessness, they listed that Kingston is doing a great job in addressing homelessness. So again, for the second ask, it's kind of more of a push towards you're doing a great job towards supporting Indigenous initiatives. We want to see more. We want you to keep doing what you're doing and kind of push that forward. Mm-hmm. So a few different ways that, again, it's a very broad ask. Support, strengthen truth and reconciliation commitments. Very broad, very abstract, if that makes sense. So a few different ways that we're kind of hoping that could go about its way could potentially be continuing to invest in more Indigenous-led supportive transitional housing initiatives. So we had a conversation with Tippi Moza, mm-hmm. which is the supportive housing, one of the main supportive housing organizations here in Kingston, and they suggested that one aspect of supportive housing that could be important was maybe having more Indigenous-specific housing centers or complexes. Right now, the Language Nest is working on helping individuals who identify as Indigenous to find housing or put in applications, and by having a center that's specifically investing in more Indigenous-led supportive housing would be really beneficial to the community at large. Another way could do this would be to increase municipal funding. Mm-hmm. Another way could do this could be to look at how the Indigenous Community Land Trust, I guess, fits into the implementation of different strategies for building housing in the future, and potentially looking into an Indigenous care center, which basically means working with the local Indigenous partners like the Language Nest to identify a site, maybe funding pathways and implementation timelines to move basically a comprehensive care center forward.
Students are now meeting with city councilors throughout the month of April and hope to bring the conversation to the provincial level as well. Ramon and Song say they've already been getting a response from the Kingston community.
From those initial conversations, I think a lot of folks were really happy that we were talking about it. They were really, the reactions that I've received was a lot of hope and a lot of just hoping that things can get better, and a lot of gratefulness as well that people were looking into this, especially as medical professionals and from the physicians that we've spoken with in our class. So for example, I did an announcement and one of our professors was talking to our class about how important it is to discuss the social determinants of health, to look at medicine outside of just what we learn in a lecture hall, but rather, and just slides, but rather the lived experiences of individuals. And then we've heard that echoed from our peers as well. So a lot of our peers have been approaching us, like a lot of folks, for example, in the first year class have approached me about how excited they are for this initiative to be able to make a difference and to also want to join this initiative if they haven't, like, you know, gotten the chance to. And I think that this shows a lot of optimism and hope that is kind of missing from the public discourse recently. I think things have been really down and sucky for the past few years just with how, I don't know, like how life has been. And I think that this offers a lot of hope and glimmer of optimism that a lot of medical students are approaching with and a lot of faculty members and community members are approaching with.
I would also say that humility has been a big aspect of our community consultation, especially as it's been a lot of learning as we talk to all these amazing organizations and speaking about all the very important and invaluable work that they've done.
Looking ahead as the group dives into conversations with counselors, the group hopes this work will have a positive impact in the Kingston community and continue to grow as an ongoing initiative within Queen's Medicine.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see where this will go. I think that one of the things that really excited me when I first wanted to bring back this event as one of the co-chairs of the Equity and Activist Committee was the fact that medical students could have so much fun learning and being so involved in the community as Queen's medical students with Kingston. I feel a lot of the times that Queen's itself feels like a big bubble where we're just nestled into downtown, not really focusing on anything else that happens in Kingston. And the School of Medicine is a smaller bubble embedded within the bigger bubble where we don't even talk to oftentimes the rest of Queens. So I think that this way, having an outlet for people to be able to contribute to the community or learn about the community through advocacy and equity, which are big foundational, I guess, skill sets that medicine or doctors needs, I think is such a great way to, I guess, be connected and understand what's going on, not only with Kingston, but also with our own beliefs and values. I think that this will hopefully be an initiative that continues to grow, not only for medical students, but also for Kingston itself.
I think like developing a culture within Queen's Medicine, but even other medical schools, for example, or even within Queen's, on how important it is for us to support our own community and be responsible for our own community. It goes down to that very basic idea of humanity that I think is always echoed in, you know, the humanities, medicine, but any field where you help someone that is in need because you are a human being and that person matters. And the benefit of another person is a benefit for myself as well. So I think that is one thing that we hope to see in medicine, especially as we progress in our careers, as we progress to become, you know, residents or attendings, that we carry this with us, this idea of community consultation, learning from others, humility, and just the humanity aspect, the compassionate care aspect.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Lori.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to your Queen's Campus Beat, Queen's Campus News, here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, or online at cfrc.ca. I'm Henry. We begin with a fire that affected a common student housing area earlier this month. According to reporting published April 7th by the Queen's Journal, a student residence located off campus experienced a fire on the evening of April 6th, which was Easter Monday. While the fire was described as brief, it prompted emergency response and raised ongoing concerns about the condition and safety of off-campus student housing in Kingston. No fatalities have been reported in connection with the incident, but the event adds to a broader pattern of attention toward housing standards in neighborhoods heavily populated by Queen's students. The property involved is part of a cluster of frequently used student rental units, underscoring the continued reliance on aging housing stock in the city's university district. Turning to student governments, new scrutiny has emerged around internal operations within the Alma Mater Society. A report published on April 3rd details concerns raised both internally and externally regarding the AMS Clubs Commission and Campus Affairs Commission. Allegations include poor communication practices and the use of inappropriate language, contributing to dissatisfaction among student groups that rely on these commissions for funding, oversight, and logistical support. This comes at a time when the AMS is already navigating instability following the March 1st resignation of former President Jana Amer and the earlier assumption of duties by incoming President Dryden George, as previously reported in student political coverage. The combination of leadership transition and operational criticism suggests ongoing challenges in restoring confidence in student governance structures heading into the 2026-2027 academic year. Financial concerns are also emerging within AMS Operation Services. It is now known that multiple student services, including the Queen's Pub and separate retail operations, are contributing to an approximate $800,000 gap between projected and actual budgets. Despite steady student use, several services have struggled to meet revenue expectations. The report highlights unsold merchandise inventory and underperforming food service operations as key factors in the shortfall. This deficit raises questions about the long-term sustainability of AMS-run businesses and whether restructuring or service reductions may be required in future budget cycles. In recent university administration news, compensation data released for 2025 is drawing new attention. The top five earners at Queen's University each receive salaries exceeding $400,000 in the 2025 fiscal year. The disclosure comes amid broader institutional budget review processes and increasing scrutiny over spending priorities. The university has already announced a review of its budget model, indicating potential structural changes in how funds are allocated across faculties and services. Thank you for listening. I've been Henry, here with Queen's Campus Beat, your Queen's Campus News on CFRC 101.9 FM.
The Queen's Gaels women's football team participated in intercollegiate flag football provincial finals last weekend. The Gaels entered the tournament as the top-ranked team in the 11-on-11 format after sweeping the regional qualifying tournament 3 weeks prior. The undefeated Gaels rolled into Fleming College looking to win the first provincial championship in program history. Though women's football has existed as a concept at Queen's for over a decade, it did not receive official club status until 2021, with their first official season taking place the following year. The team would medal in both 2024 and 2025, building a solid foundation of young players and veterans alike. 2026 marked the breakthrough season for the program, with convincing tournament wins in February and March, earning them a spot in the Football Ontario Provincial Championships in the Tier 1 division. Queens would meet the Western Mustangs in the provincial final, a rematch of March's regional tournament final. The defense, led by fourth-year defender and CFRC alumnus Claire Chow, would smother Western's passing game, while the Queens quarterback, Isabella Shee, would throw three touchdowns to power the Gales to a commanding 27-0 victory and their first provincial title in program history. The Gales will advance to the Football Canada National Finals in Regina. The national finals begin May 1st, and the team is looking to raise funds to cover travel costs. Donations can be made through the Queen's University Giving Portal. For more information, you can also visit the Queen's Women's Football page's social media at QueensWFootball on Instagram. In other sports news, two members of the Queen's Women's Rugby team have been selected to the Canadian National Team. Lizzie Gibson and Chloe Daniels will join two other Queen's alumnus in Taylor Perry and Sophie DeGuti on the roster for the Pacific Four Series. Gibson finished her Queen's career as the program's all-time leading scorer with a staggering 569 career points, breaking the record formerly held by DeGuti. Chloe Daniels played a key role in Canada's silver medal performance at the 2024 Paris Summer Olympics and has won a number of team awards and conference awards over the course of her accomplished Queen's career. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, April 13th, daytime high of 12 degrees, 55% chance of precipitation, going to drop down to 5 overnight. Tuesday, April 14th, slightly warmer, daytime high of 13 degrees, but a 70% chance of rain in the forecast, dropping down to 7 overnight. Wednesday, April 15th, the warmest day of the year so far, daytime high of 18 degrees with a 68% chance of precipitation in the forecast. Thursday, April 16th, the first day of the week not to be projected to have rain, daytime high of 14 degrees, going to feel closer to 13, cloudy conditions dropping down to 9 overnight. Friday, April 17th, another high double-digit day, 16 degrees, but we do have a 55% chance of precipitation that will cool things off quite a bit overnight, dropping down to 2, and cooling things off for the weekend, as Saturday, April 18th, we have a high of 10 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling slightly colder around 8. Sunday, April 19th, we've got an 11-degree day in the forecast with a mix of sun and cloud, but it is actually going to feel quite a bit warmer than the 11-degree temperature in the sun. It'll feel up to 16 on Sunday, April 19th. And then starting off next week, Monday, April 20th, daytime high of 11 degrees, but a 62% chance of rain means it's going to feel closer to 8. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week, and just bear in mind, winter overnight street parking restrictions have been lifted as of April 1st. We begin with two long-term road closures. Barry Street to Queen is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. We have some short-term road closures as well, including Wright Crescent at Palace Road, which is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Wright Crescent. There is a minimal traffic disruption on Bath Road to Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard. Expect delays for the installation of intersection pedestrian signals. The city is installing intersection pedestrian signals at several locations to make it easier and safer for pedestrians to cross busy roads. They are installing these signals at the following intersections: Bath Road at Lafleur Park, Concession Street at Kings Court Avenue, and Stephen Street at Patrick Street. And that's a wrap for your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Safe driving, everybody.
This is Christina Laurie coming back with K-Town's hottest events and concerts coming up this week. After the show wraps up, you can head to karaoke at Timeout Bar starting at 6, followed by Lindy Hop swing dance lessons at the J-Duck in Wallace Hall on Queen's Campus at 7. Trivia fans can check out One Night Jacks at 7, The Brass Pub at 7:45, or Something in the Water Brewing at 8. Tomorrow on Tuesday, April 14th, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 to 5 in Springer Market Square. In the evening, Tet Tuesday Collage Club goes from 6:30 to 8:30, and there's Euchre at Daft Brewing at 7. Wednesday, April 15th, board games kick things off at Something in the Water at 5 and the Royal Canadian Legion at 6. Alongside karaoke at Timeout Bar at 6, trivia at Daft Brewing starting at 7, and the Grad Club hosts an open stage drag show at 8, followed by a drag and burlesque show at 8:30. Thursday, April 16th, the Kingston Public Market returns from 8:30 to 5. The Kingston Symphony Spring Vinyl Sale kicks off, running from 4 to 8, and a needle-felted landscape workshop takes place at the Ted Center at 6. Later on in the evening, enjoy drag bingo at Daft Brewing at 7. There is also no shortage of trivia on Thursday with Riverhead at 8, the Grad Club at 8, Something in the Water at 8, and Queen's Pub at 9. Karaoke runs at Jersey's at 8:30 and The Buckle at 9. Friday, April 17th, the Kingston Symphony Spring Vinyl Sale continues from 10 to 6. There's group art therapy at the Tet Center from 6 to 8, trivia at Wild Wings at 7, and the Just for Laughs Roadshow at the Kingston Grand Theater at 7:30. The Ground Up Dance Festival also takes place at the Tet at 8, and there's karaoke at Daft Brewing and The Buckle both at 9. On Saturday, April 18th, the Kingston Symphony Spring Vinyl Sale wraps up from 10 to 4. The Eastern Ontario Spring Stamp Festival runs from 10 to 3 at Crossroads United Church. And to keep on your radar, Record Store Day takes place across several local shops throughout the day. In the evening, you can check out Comedy Debates at The Buckle and Family Feud at Daft Brewing at 8. On Sunday, April 19th, the final day of the Kingston Symphony Spring Vinyl Sale runs from 10 to 2. Karaoke wraps up the weekend at The Merchant and The Toucan, both starting at 9. That was a quick run through of your events for the week. Now into concerts. Tonight, Monday, April 13th, Misty City Music Fest hits The Merchant at 7, and the Morning Doves play Musiki at 8. Tuesday, April 14th, Tom's Tunes Day Happy Hour Jam starts at the RCHA at 4. Kristen Martell plays The Coven at 5. Jen Grant performs at the Broom Factory at 7:30, and there's an open mic at Musiki at 8. Wednesday, April 15th, DJ Great White spins at Hotel Wolf Island. Nolan Hubbard performs at the Bank Gastro Bar at 5:30, and there's an open mic at Hotel Wolf Island starting at 7:30. Thursday, April 16th, Nolan Hubbard plays The Coven at 5, followed by Michael George Jam Night at the RCHA at 6:30. Open Season performs at Hotel Wolf Island at 7, Jinx, Naked by 9, and Johnson Street hit the Ale House at 8:30, and the Lazarettes play the Toucan at 9:30. Friday, April 17th, a packed night for concerts. An open mic takes place at Storington Lions Club at 5:30, followed by Christopher Jackson at Lakeside Barn Grill at 7 and Lynn Miles at Hotel Wolf Island at 7. The Grapes of Wrath acoustic duo perform at Signal Brewery at 7:30. Guilty Pleasures play Time Out at 8. Mellow Lily is at Tiernanog at 9. And late night shows include Dr. Bombay at The Merchant and Tone Cats at The Toucan at 10:30. Saturday, April 18th, Tyler Brett Forks performs at the Social YGK at 7. John Butler takes the stage at the Kingston Grand Theater at 7:30. Alongside a Michael Jackson tribute at La Vida Bistro Bar, Sons of Rick and Doghouse at the Broom Factory, and the She Sings Women's Choir Spring Concert at Chalmers United Church. Rumpus, Matt Almeida, and Slim play Overtime at 8. August West performs at Tiernanog at 9. And late night sets include the Oreos at The Merchant and Rocket Surgery at The Toucan, both at 10:30. Finishing off the week, Sunday, April 19th, Tom Savage and Friends perform at the Kingston Yacht Club from 2 to 5. And Il Chanteuse, Chantal Thompson, and Hugh Christopher Brown take the stage at Hotel Wolf Island at 6. That's a quick look at what's happening around Kingston this week. For more details on these events and for the full list of events and concerts, head to our calendars on cfrc.ca. Have an event you'd like to add to our online and on-air calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca at CFRC Music or on Instagram using the link tree in our bio.
Thanks
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Hey, this is Laura Jane Grace from Against Me, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 311. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a series of interventions, talks that were given at a public event here in Montreal at a space called Alternatives. I organized an event in this space with a bunch of people who contributed to a small publication, a zine, that was simply called Solidarity. And it is a zine where I invited people to share their reflections about their participation in one particular Palestine Solidarity action, a protest against forced starvation in Gaza in the context of genocide unleashed by the Israeli state. This, of course, is an issue that has been put forth to international legal authorities and is being litigated right now. I invited people locally who participated in a protest outside of the U.S. consulate here in Montreal to protest forced starvation in Gaza. And I invited people who participated in that particular action and who have been joining many solidarity actions over the last months and years to speak about why they continue to show up, why they continue to take the streets at a time when it seems the powerful are not listening. You'll hear from Michelle Hartman at McGill University, a professor and educator, Norma Rantisi at Concordia University from the Geography Department, and Vijay Kolinjivadi of the School of Community and Public Affairs at Concordia University, as well as Nail, who is a Palestinian worker and participant in the Palestine Solidarity Movement in Montreal. Here are the reflections shared by these four voices on this week's edition of Free City Radio.
So I'll first start to say that in response to this mass mobilization here in the city for Palestine, one of the things that comes to mind is how do we think about our infrastructure of resistance? So I think there's a problematic here that we have to name, because we're talking about the hand that is pointing towards Palestine, right? And so we're the hand that is pointing towards Palestine, right? But the center is Palestine, right? And so how do we think about the fact that we need to lift up our hands and point towards Palestine and speak out, but also build an infrastructure that can find a way to actually have a structural relationship to the movement in Palestine that's fighting colonialism on the ground. Of course, that includes the diaspora, but it also calls on us to think about the infrastructures of this society and how do we create alternative infrastructures that can actually build a process of resistance to the financial mechanisms of complicity, but also the cultural and social mechanisms of complicity, right? And this is a moment where we're, I think, called upon to think about those infrastructures and to think about also lifting up and supporting cultural work on the ground in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, that is resisting genocide through cultural production, right? So thinking here about Radio Al-Hara, who we're recording for right now in Bethlehem, in the occupied territories, as a project of cultural production on the ground in Palestine run by Palestinians. So those of you who contributed to this zine, simply called Solidarity, the design is by Leon Lowe, who worked on this design, I believe, in 2020 or 2021. It was actually a demonstration that was called to protest the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement, which I think is, you know, a very clear illustration of the infrastructure of complicity on the part of the Canadian state. One of the first international trade agreements that the Canadian government signed. And then Leon sort of carried that design forward, and then we've included everybody's texts. So for those who shared their reasons for attending a demonstration on July 22nd here in Montreal that was called for by the Palestinian youth movement outside of the U.S. consulate to protest genocidal policies and the intention of creating conditions and the realities of mass starvation in Gaza, people have shared some texts. So maybe you could talk about what you shared in this small community publication, but also reflect a little bit about your choice to be part of this effort to create an infrastructure of resistance, and think about this sort of process of remaining on the streets in the face of incredible odds. We see Palestinians holding the land with their hearts, with their bodies, dying on the land in resistance to colonialism. And so there can be a cultural disconnect from that reality, but the reality is that, you know, as we know, the infrastructures of power here are inherently connected, which means we are inherently connected. Those are just some thoughts. Maybe I'll just sort of gauge who would like to comment first. Also, please take it in another direction if you'd like to. I'm just sort of sharing some comments for those who might be tuning in on the radio internationally. And shout out to Saeed, Ibrahim, Elias, Yusuf, and Yazin, who launched Radio Al-Hara and have sustained it. It's really become an important platform around the world, so big respect to all of you.
My name's Michelle. And when you ask the question of why did we go out to the demonstration, I was, you know, you can, I mean, I could answer it like so many different ways. And one of the really honest answers to give is that I would go to every demonstration unless I can't go, right? Like I do, I go to every single demonstration. So what that's meant in the last 2 years, given like what Montreal is like, you could go to a demonstration like every 2 to 3 days, which is, you know, challenging to do when you have a job or you're doing different kinds of things. And this particular demonstration was like a couple days after I had just gotten back from Lebanon. And so I was like really tired and jet lagged and so on. But there was this demonstration. So I thought, okay, like, you know, I'm going to go like I always go. And so I actually did that day think a little bit about it. Like often I don't think about it. I just kind of do it. And one of the things that I really was very aware of because I had just come back was that given how interconnected we are with the kind of social media and the internet, things like these radio shows that we can record here, but you can hear them in Palestine or, you know, like all of these kinds of connections, is that the solidarity that you can show, people notice and it does make a difference. Like people see if there are 15 people on the street of Montreal or 2,000 people on the street of Montreal or 50 people on the streets of Montreal. So many people who I met this summer in Lebanon talked about really being kind of surprised how many people so far away went down on the streets and would chant on the streets and would people kept talking like to me about how hard it must be here and how difficult it is here, and they know about the repression in the universities and the repression on the streets and so on. And like it's like this disconnect for me because people who are there are facing much more serious things than we're facing here. People have had their houses destroyed. People like can be, or we're getting, when we were there, droned. Cars were getting droned and people blown up. And like, it's much, much more serious kind of consequences that what we face. But that kind of person to person solidarity, like real people having real conversations and like seeing those things, and it's really very moving. So like, I think that idea that, you know, so in a way we're doing it for ourselves, but in a way, like, even though we are doing it for ourselves, we are also creating connections with people who are really, really, really far away. So I think, you know, like geographically, right? I think that's kind of something that I do think about as part of why I go out, even though it's not sort of like maybe the reason or the main reason or whatever. I think that another thing that I would underline is that, you know, when you talk about building the infrastructure, is that the habit of going and being together is important, and that the being together in a demonstration, there's a lot of different parts of it. Maybe we talk about some of this later, but so I teach literature, so I'm interested in poetry. So I actually am very interested in what happens when people are together and chanting, because chanting is like poetry, right? And you say the same things week after week. And I teach literature, and I teach literature that is between Arabic and English. And so one of the things that I've also been really interested in is how so many people, especially young people, now are learning Arabic, and people want to learn Arabic, and all these people are saying words in Arabic. And like, it's really weird, you know, for like, it's not something that I've been used to, is like people always are asking what the chants mean, and they're trying to learn the words, and they're repeating the words, and there's all these non-Arabic speaking people chanting Arabic chants week after week. Is really not something I've experienced in my life, and that's really interesting. And I think that's both solidarity, but it's also education, but that also like builds capacity, as we say, right? And that kind of that's one of the things in the demonstrations that is what you could put in the kind of category of education. And I think education or learning is part of what we also do in demonstrations. Like, so we've got the language example and the poetry example and this like being together and being in the practice of like walking together. But like when you go to a demonstration, you also like talk to people, and you talk to people like, let's say, you know, Norma, who I'm sitting next to, like we would see each other and maybe we would catch up and we would talk and we'd have that space. Or maybe I see Stefan, who I haven't seen in a long time, but maybe I talk to some random person because they're standing next to me. And then I've met like a neighbor, or I've met another person, and we build our communities like that too. And that also builds our infrastructures, like, because we're coming together around different things. Like, I can't think of any demonstration I've been to where I haven't like some new person, thing, idea, chant, political analysis hasn't come up. Like every demonstration, like there's always something new. There's always something different. There's always some way that you can like push yourself into thinking about things. And then that itself builds us up together, like individually, but also as communities, to then do this work, right?
Maybe I'll just add to that, because I really felt like that was a great overview of a lot of key motivations for going out and being together, is that people there are also so aware of this intricate links and the power kind of dynamics, and they're watching. They are. You're right. I mean, I know it's the case, like you were saying, in Lebanon, but it's also the case in Palestine. I was there last summer, too, and so many people were talking about the fact that they were watching people on the street, and that they were so moved by youth, like, you know, making claims on their governments and their institutions. And and at the time, I was, you know, meeting with one human rights, director of a human rights organization who had been through a lot, been imprisoned, had their office completely, like, you know, ransacked, and even they were locked out for a bit, and saying, you know, like, this gives us some hope, at least, to know that in the heart of empire, we're seeing people going out and being very visible and, you know, and taking space and mobilizing. So I think that's really critical, too. So there are days, actually, you mentioned cynicism, where I don't want to go to the demos, to be honest. I'm just tired of doing this week in, week out, you know. I don't know. And feeling some futility to it because of just the concentration of power, right? And the way it's wielded in Gaza in particular. But But sometimes that very person's words will, you know, echo in my ears, and I'll think, you know, this is not about you and your own sense of futility. There's something bigger that has to drive you, right? And so, yeah, I think that's always important, is to keeping those connections in mind, right? That it's not just even, you know, about here and now, but it's about the ripple effects, you know, even across oceans. And but in terms of the here and now, to the extent that it really is significant and matters, I think, as Michelle has mentioned, you know, these are the seeds of building the communities, right? Of forming relationships that then we can carry into other spaces. You know, I've been walking on the street with many of the people around this table, actually, some of whom I didn't even know their names until today, right? So, that's critical for growing a movement.
I actually prepared something that I might want to say, and I think maybe it speaks a little bit to what Norma said about this futility of being there in week after week, but then knowing there's something deeper, perhaps more central to all of this, that's more than just what it is of being there on the street. It's something more. And so I'll read it. And I wrote this very, very fast. So it came out of emotion. So it's kind of, but it is just something that really I had to kind of put down. So I'll just read it. And it just to say, it comes also from a conversation I had with my friend Tamadur, who grew up, who is in Belgium now, unable to go back home, grew up in the Al Arub refugee camp in the south of the West Bank, one of the things that she told me recently was, we are the creative force for our life. And so I was just thinking that this is a secret that the colonizer can never control us, because they'll never be able to fully understand that secret. And that's why we are alive. That's why we still exist. That's why our heart beats and our eyes grow wide when we see each other in these demos. Strangers, those we know, and all that is, you know, that in that moment it means everything to be there. It means it all to be there in that moment, and it's a force that can't be controlled. So this colonial order exists, basically giving complete support to this, to what we are seeing unfolding right now in Gaza, but over the last 70 years plus, is this living, what we are seeing is this kind of living, beating heart of this, of what has kept 530 years now of this racial, violent, global racial empire going. And the complicity of all the Western states in fueling it should not be a surprise because of that, I think. So I think it's really the only thing they know, and it's how to be violent. That's all they know. And I was thinking of something that Francesca Albanese wrote in the Insecurity Monitor. She's the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Palestine Territory. She said that settler colonial societies always hold the seeds of genocide. They can and will do it again and again. And so they are maintaining the conditions of ethnic cleansing and erasure. And as we stand in a settler colonial society now, we know that this society is capable of maintaining those conditions again and again and again, and will continue to do that. So my research and what I teach is about kind of the cause and consequence of our global ecological crisis. I argue in the work that I do that it is the culmination, the ecological breakdown is the culmination of global racial empire. It's an ecologizing project. Global racial empire is an ecology. It's an ecologizing project of control and domination. So that means unfreedom, removing the freedom of some people or some place, some nature, some places, of calculability, of predictability, of efficiency. It's this mentality of white supremacy is one of normalizing murder, while still talking about creating a, quote, just and equal world, or a society with human rights. But really, there's no limit to what they can do to maintain that world order and to keep us all quiet, complacent, and acquiescent to it. I think about the people who walk in the when we are protesting. There are many people who just walk by, and sometimes, you know, there are people who try to bring them in to the demonstration. And it's not that, you know, there's many reasons why people are not necessarily marching. But the structure of the society is one that wants to keep us walking to the next shop, walk us to the next business we have to do, keep our schedules going. And it's not even a world order, let's say, because the views of this sort of white supremacist view, this global racial project, let's say, disregards the earth, the very planet that keeps them alive. So the joke is on them. Their view is to remove our humanity, to remove all life, to make us all dead. And again, the joke is on them. So I often think about how it's possible for people to care about all living things, about living in general, about life, about themselves, about their mothers, about their children, about their partners, about their cats, about any possible reason to be living, if one is normalizing their complicity in mass murder by remaining quiet in front of their leaders and employers. That to me, if I have to say it in that way, I would say it that way. And I include myself to some degree there because my words get ahead of my actions. And I again, I recall my friend Tamador's voice when she says, "Do not let fear control you. Justice has no meaning in any other situation if Palestine is not liberated. People cannot be fighting for a better environment, for a society that will meet their needs, unless their society is based upon de-investment in the settler colonial project and reinvestment in the autonomy to revitalize lifeways that have been damaged because of this project." That is the infrastructure that we need to build, I think. And that's why Palestine is so important for everything that it means to be alive right now in this world today, to stop this mass murder of people. And if a society like this is gaining symbolically, materially, rhetorically, in any way from what is happening, the question is not even about complacency. It's about pure joy. The joy of murder and killing for gain, a gain in political position, a gain in arms sale, a gain in academic collaboration, an economic gain in a new trading partner, whatever gain it may be. And that is a depraved, sick, psychopathic condition. One, I will never reject, I won't reject as long as I am alive. So in my intervention in the zine, I wrote, you know, the act of protesting will not give food to those in Gaza. But by being there, I ask, you know, does it help us to be alive? You know, are we alive? What does it truly mean to be alive today in that sense? They tell us that, you know, we can eat healthy to be alive, or to, you know, take these pills that will be alive. But that's not stopping our collective deadening because of this violent system. So I go out on the street as much as I'm able to recall life, and that, yeah, we are this creative force for the world we want. And we go out to remember life in each other's eyes for a liberated Palestine. And actually, finally, just to say, you know, we don't even need a motivation to go. We know in our heart, we know in our life, if we are alive, that we have to be out there as much as we can.
Yeah, so I guess going off of what Michelle said, you know, I was there because I made myself a promise that I'd be at any protest. And I've lived in Montreal for 7 years now, and before that was easy, and now it's hard because there's a lot of things happening, and that's amazing. And, you know, I think the number one reason is personal. It's emotional. It is invigorating to be on the street. You got the drummers, you have people out there, you have the chanting. It feels like a rally sometimes, and sometimes it feels a bit bad even, because you're like, I'm kind of enjoying myself, and it's, you know, there's very serious things happening. It's an emotional release. But you also, the way most of us have experienced this genocide, I mean, everyone in this room, except Norma and Michelle and maybe others who've recently traveled to Palestine and Lebanon, it's through our phones. And it's really nice to be in real life and see who your friends are and see who your enemies are, because sometimes they show up too. And it is nice to kind of ground yourself and be like, that motherfucker is standing, I don't know if I can swear, that motherfucker is standing to support the death of children, and he's proud of it. And it is good to remind yourself that that's out there, because it helps you steel yourself for what you have to do and how you have to show up. And I think if I were to take your question in another direction, it's almost that, you know, why do we go there? It's kind of obvious to all of us who are there, but why are people not there? You know, as Vijay kind of alluded to, the people who walk by. And I've asked a few people that I know, because I know they're sympathetic people, and a lot of them are from countries who have suffered under colonization. Some of them are Palestinian. Some of them are Lebanese. They feel like it's not going to make a difference. And I would really ask those people, in countries where they're not protesting, what's happening? In Egypt, we haven't seen a mass protest movement. They're signing gas deals at the time when starvation is at the peak. In Jordan, the protests have died, and people notice this. You know, I saw a video a little while ago. People probably know Sama Al-Khudur. You know, she's a very prominent member of her Montreal community. She lost her daughter in Gaza due to the racist immigration policies of Mark Miller and Justin Trudeau. And she posted a video of children who saw a video of a protest in Montreal, and they were chanting along, you know, the way that they saw us chanting in the video. So, and if I were to push back on the idea of protests a little bit, you know, in Canada, you know, and in the West, protests are kind of part of how we pitch ourselves to the world. It's a sign that we live in a civilized, democratic society. It can very easily turn to a tool of crushing dissent. So I think it's really important to go to those protests with the mentality of, you're building something. This is a start point, not an end point. You know, they should get, it's a cumulative effect too. You know, we've been very consistent, I think more consistent than any other movement I've seen in my lifetime. And when you go every week, you see the same people, you start to have familiarity with them, and you build those connections. And that can lead you to the next thing. If the protests aren't working, well then, here, you have the platform to move on. So
that was the voices of four people who contributed to a zine that I published. I'm Stefan Christoph, the host of Free City Radio, and the zine is simply called Solidarity. It is looking at why continuing to show up and bear witness to the injustice in Palestine is important. Thank you so much to Michelle Hartman, professor at McGill University, Norma Rantisi of the Geography Department at Concordia, Vijay Kolanjivadi of the School of Community and Public Affairs at Concordia University, and Nail, who is a Palestinian worker and protest participant. You can find this zine online through the Just Seeds Artist Cooperative. Just visit justseeds.org, and you can check out their blog section. There's a free PDF download. I'm Stefan Kristoff. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Free City Radio. And thanks to the Social Justice Center at Concordia University for your support. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal. On Thursdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/free. City Radio. I'm Stefan Kristoff. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll speak to you next week.